Good morning. HBR got a Labor Day surprise. Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew walked in the door. We'll hear his view of the TPP, Hawaii's economy, and the G20 meeting he had just left. How many species and ecosystems have been or are in danger of being lost are listed on this year's IUCN Red List. After its release this week, we ask one of the project's conservation biologists, now what? And continuing our focus on Hawaii issues also facing peoples around the world, a look at conservation through elder eyes. We talk with the principal of the Benin Film Project. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Bill Sage. Let's make this perfectly clear. And the best way to start is by using the gravitational lensing effect predicted by Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Bill Sage.
Good morning, Beth Ann. On a day like today, I guess one would say something like, Imalama kamana'o o na kupuna, which means essentially preserve the thoughts of the elders. I'm not sure how you'd say that in Benin, but it's a thought.
Or at least in French.
Je ne parle pas le français parce que je suis américain.
Oh, well, you've done better than most. And that takes us to our first conversation rather well. Now, most Hawaii residents are now hearing the acronym IUCN, likely more than they have ever heard it in the past. But for those who work with and for the International Union for Conservation of Nature, the IUCN is a routine part of their lives. That would include Dode, and I'm going to try saying his last name. It's Huehunga. Close?
Yeah, it's okay.
Or maybe you say it better.
Huehunga.
Well, there you go. Yeah. He is a forestry management engineer from the West African country of Benin. He's also in charge of the IUCN World Commission on Protected Areas Young Professionals Group. That would be for the West and Central Africa region. Continuing our look at Hawaii through world eyes, Dode joins us now to consider the role of elders in conservation, documented in a film he produced as part of the Benin Film Project. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks. It's for me a great opportunity to talk about this project. Sorry, my English is not fluently, but I will try to do this interview.
I think you're doing very, very well. And we talked yesterday, so I know you're doing very well. How did the idea for this film come to be with you as a forestry management engineer and also your partner who is similarly engaged?
This project started in 2015 in Benin. We have a discussion with my big bro, Jose Adosu Bojenu, it's manager of Nature Tropical NGO. We did a constat is that young isn't connected with the nature. And we developed this idea to reconnect Nyonf with nature, to develop partnership between Nyonf and elders to conserve our nature. And we chose, our main choice is sacricide in Benin because we have many sacricide in south of Benin. And the main objective is to reconnect Nyonf to their sacrifice and develop partnership between youth and elders.
Making that connection between youth and elders is an issue all around the world, it seems. But when you talk about the sacred sites of Benin, what sacred sites are you talking about? Which sites are they?
In our mind in Benin, when we talk about sacrifice, we think that is not good, is dangerous for young people. But today in our country, the main constant is that sacricide is better protected, like forest protected by our government, because elders have many knowledge which can help to protect effectively our site.
So when we're talking about which sacred sites, you're talking about the forests, What else are you talking about?
We talk about forest okay. sacred site.
Okay, so they're all located in the forest, nothing on the coast.
Yeah, we have many forests in south of Benin, but like to close to our capital, Port Novo, we have two sacred sites which are better protected today. And we use those sacred sites to our film.
When you made the film, how did you go about approaching elders to talk about it? And were they really eager? You know, did they want to talk about this?
Yeah, it was very difficult, but, you know, it's very easy to a father to discuss with his son. So we go to the main capital, Cotonou, and Lomé, and we chose Youth Leaders. Youth Leaders coming from a youth organization. We select for the first training 50 young, and we go back in their sacred site, and we discuss with elders. They think that is very good idea because in the past they haven't opportunities to discuss with Nyonf. So because Nyonf think that elder is traditional, is not actuality, and they can't discuss about actuality with elders. So they accept to discuss and share experience, knowledge with you.
Sometimes that view of elders by the young or youth mm-hmm. is, you know, one that we hear about a lot in the United States, mm-hmm. that sense of being disconnected, that they don't understand, mm-hmm. until you get a little older mm-hmm. and you figure out that maybe they were pretty wise and they had some good ideas that had developed over time because mm-hmm. they lived long enough mm-hmm. to see what had happened. As you look at Hawaii, you've been here just a little while, but you've had a lot of discussion over the last week or so. What kind of message would you give to Hawaii youth and elders too?
Yeah, I think that Hawaii has a very, very, it's a very beautiful town, and they have many capacity. I had many discussions with indigenous communities, and they have also many knowledge which they can share today with young, our young people. And my main message is that young from Hawaii must be discussed with elders to learn with those people and use the knowledge to conserve for the next generation Hawaii tradition.
So this is not just about, as we often hear elders say, we need to do this for the next generation, for our children, but really it's a matter of the children and the elders working together and having more intergenerational focus on conservation than having one generation preserve it just for the next.
Yeah, because we have just one Earth, and it's very important to develop the partnership between Nyonf and elders.
Thank you so much for
you are welcome
for being here and doing so well in English.
Many thanks, and thanks also to Naturefall, because we developed this project to Naturefall, which is a global and inclusive initiative today.
And we should say the film has been shown at the IUCN and will be perhaps distributed, although, as you told me earlier, it's in French
but
without subtitles yet.
Yeah, I can send you the files, but it's in French. Maybe we can work together to translate it in English to share this experience from Benin.
That would be wonderful, Dode. Thank you so much for coming in.
Many thanks.
We'll look forward to that. And I want to tell you that Dode is an engineer from Benin, and he is in forestry management. He's also a volunteer in charge of activities for the IUCN World Commission on Protected Areas Young Professionals Group in the West and Central Africa region. That includes the film we were just discussing on how elders and youth have been connected to help with conservation, and it was produced as part of the Benin Film Project.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HBR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, seeking distortion-free clarity in the water and the Secretary of the Treasury. But first, putting the Ohia Lele Plateau in the backyard.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholave, uhavai.
Later in the show, we're going to be talking about what comes next after we've all seen the IUCN Red List. For now, in today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of the many species that has gone extinct in Hawaii. This one was a scarlet red beauty, about 5 inches long. It was last seen on Molokai in 1963, although some reports have it surviving into the 70s. People said the bird looked like a ball of flame, especially males. They were bright red all around. Females, though, were less colorful. They were a little bit more brown on their bellies. Their call was compared to the sound of someone cutting wood in the distance. A British naturalist from the 19th century was one of the first to write about them. He found a female and two males while lost in a fog on Molokai. They were endangered even then, and because of their bright red feathers, they were sought after for the robes and cloaks of the ali'i. We're looking for the name of the bird, and if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the T-shirt.
With Hawaii's pristine shoreline ecosystems, you may have marveled at the water's clarity, but even if the water is smooth as glass, one little ripple, one little puff of breeze, everything is distorted. Well, until now, that is. It seems like there is a way of making water that is clear as glass actually appear to be clear as glass. And with us today is NASA scientist Dr. Ved Chiriath. Thank you so much for being here this morning, and if you could describe... You started out in astrophysics?
My pleasure, yes, and thank you for having me. Yes, my background's in astrophysics and studying theoretical physics and the history of the universe on very small scales as well as very large scales.
So the macro, I guess, looking up in the telescopes, observing Mauna Kea, and we have this pesky thing that makes stars twinkle, atmospheric distortion. What was the principle behind de-distorting, for a made-up layman's term?
Sure. So this was definitely inspired by astrophysics and the techniques we use in adaptive optics as well as with gravitational lensing and looking through fluids and large-scale distortions as well as exploiting them.
For those people who are wanting gravitational lensing, you don't have to be an Einstein. You do have to be an Einstein to figure that out. So what is gravitational lensing and its principle?
Sure. Gravitational lensing is one of the most amazing phenomena predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity. And essentially, large objects, like a large cluster of galaxies, will bend light itself around them. And so we can see objects behind them that are curved, and they appear lensed in effect at very, very long distances.
So with this principle and the atmosphere twinkling the stars out there, what do you do? What's the nuts and bolts, if I may use a term, approach to actually get rid of those ripples with the help of lensing?
So in the case of astrophysics, the problem is it's very complicated because the atmosphere is such a long optical path and there's so many different things that distort light along its path down to Earth, including clouds, the occasional bird, density ripples. With gravitational lensing, it's equally complicated with large-scale distortions of space-time itself. But this really inspired the approach we have on looking at Earth. I learned that we do not have a comparable technology to look through the ocean surface, and the ocean covers 70% of our planet. It's really our life support system, and so that's sort of what inspired me to try applying techniques borrowed from astronomy to the ocean surface and develop a new method to look through it.
So we've got about 80, 90 miles of rippling atmosphere, and then you've maybe got 2 or 3 feet of rippling water, and those 2 or 3 feet are just enough to completely distort something you'd like to look at. And for practical purposes, the reefs, they're so near but yet so far, and if you sit there with a little pair of goggles and just go back and forth, but it's going to take a long time. So your principle was applied in such a way, and then you take it from there.
Sure. So essentially, when ocean waves pass over objects, although they distort them, and the distortion can be quite severe because of the large refractive index jump between air and water, there's moments where the wave will actually magnify what you're seeing underwater, and you can see this effect at a swimming pool, or if you go to the beach, you'll notice objects being momentarily magnified.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what inspired me to not only remove the distortion that we see from ocean waves, but actually use the waves to enhance our capabilities and look deeper. And so one of the methods that fluid lensing uses, which is the technology that I invented to look through the ocean surface, is to exploit these magnifying lensing events. And so every time we see a positive wave pass over a region with a certain curvature, we exploit that and we actually can enhance the optical performance of our system and image things down at the sub-centimeter scale while we're flying above a reef. In addition to that, these lenses form these brilliant bands of moving light called caustics.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, you can see these at the shoreline or again in a swimming pool. And light will actually be magnified, sometimes many times brighter than
it
would be.
That's sort of the lacy light pattern you see.
Absolutely. And I've spent a lot of time looking at caustics as a result because they're so tied to the fluid surface and what's going on. But what's so exciting is that the second challenge that we have with ocean remote sensing is that light doesn't penetrate very deep. In the water column. Typically, you know, in very clear natural waters, you'll get about 100 meters of penetration depth.
Which is about 350 feet or so.
Right. If you look at, you know, the entire planet, that's not a very large amount of light to come back at you. And so we really cannot see much of the seafloor. Less than about 3% of the seafloor has been mapped by NASA, whereas we've mapped Mars and the Moon nearly completely.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of startling considering we don't live on either of those worlds. So just going back to the ocean, this problem of optical absorption in the water column has also limited our abilities and how far we can image and what we can see. And caustics sort of provide another enhancement, if you will, to looking at ocean reef systems because they light them up and they kind of have a little sweeping scanner that moves across them. So fluid lensing also exploits these caustic bands to look deeper in the water column and to be able to resolve corals at the centimeter scale.
And the practical depth for which you could do this, I imagine, because for the health of a reef ecosystem, you can get the overall picture just by doing patterns with a drone and a grid sort and just going back and forth until you have a complete map?
Yes. So in the two test cases, we've been testing this technology, and the first was in American Samoa and the other in Hamlin Pool, Western Australia. And we're studying two reef systems there. One is coral reefs. The other is stromatolite reefs, which are even older.
The stromatolites are the one that have been around for billions of years, probably.
Yes. There are our great, you know, to the power of 10 ancestors.
The ones who said, hi, we were here first.
Yes, and they politely oxygenated the atmosphere, so we have a lot to be grateful to them for.
Thank you, stromatolites.
Over about 3 billion years, they raised the oxygen content from 0% and in a very hostile world to about 25% in the Precambrian.
It's nice of you to be thoughtful to stromatoliths. I mean, these little guys are sitting there, so you're looking at them, and you also can tell about the health of any reef system by getting a much clearer optical.
Correct. And really, you can't conserve what you don't see and you don't know about. And so we've been testing this to image things at the sub-centimeter scale and centimeter scale, really because corals grow at those scales.
Yeah.
Per year, it's about 1 centimeter of growth. Stromatolites are about 1 millimeter of growth per year. And so to understand how our increasing anthropogenic climate stressors are affecting them, we really have to be able to see them at the scale and to get in the water with them.
I wish we had more time, but time, unfortunately, cannot be really stretched or compressed that much, but you're going to be having an exhibit about this at the IUCN convention.
Yes, I'd encourage the public to come visit the USA Pavilion. We have NASA as well as NOAA and a number of other state and federal agencies talking about conservation, showing the work that we're doing to understand these systems. One of the highlights, I think, of this IUCN WCC is that it coincided with the expansion of the Papahanaumokuakea National Marine Sanctuary, which is just it's such an encouraging thing to see, because we've conserved less than 3% of the ocean surface, whereas 15% of land.
Well, I can truly say pictures are worth billions and billions of words in this case. Ved, it's wonderful that you are here today. Thank you so much, and best of luck in all your future endeavors in making the world a much clearer place for all of us.
Thank you all for having me.
Dr. Ved Shurayath leads the NASA Ames Laboratory for Advanced Sensing in the Earth Science Division. He works with a multidisciplinary team creating machine learning algorithms to process Earth science data on the NASA Ames Earth Exchange supercomputing facility. See our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, for more about his team's amazing advances.
You hear a lot about HPR sustaining members for a simple reason. We couldn't survive without them. HPR sustainers make it possible for the station to have predictable, reliable monthly income to keep HPR coming to you every day. Please become part of one of the best groups we know, HPR sustaining members. Call us at 955-8821, or you can donate at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Last year, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs realized it had an image problem. And this year, it hired a PR firm to help. But will spending almost $300,000 over the next 2 years fix it? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has this reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
So normally when anyone or an organization or a company has an image problem, it's kind of a natural thing to go to a PR group to try to fix it. But in this case, is this appropriate?
Well, it's a government agency, and I think that certainly raises some questions. But, you know, it's not uncommon for some agencies to have PR firms. For example, the Hawaii Tourism Authority, which is a government agency as well, and has a PR firm helping get its message out. In the case of OHA, what they did is they had Stryker Weiner and Yokota, which is a very prominent local PR firm with a lot of clients that you would recognize, including Ala Moana Center and any number of others. And they conducted a survey among non-Hawaiians and Hawaiians, and what they found out was a little bit disturbing. About a third of the people surveyed said OHA is poorly managed, it's ineffective, even corrupt. About that same number, or slightly less, said it doesn't really help Hawaiians. And it also determined that priorities for OHA should really be education and taking care of land, the aina, not nation building. And as you know, there's been a lot of focus on nation building lately. So this was kind of eyebrow-raising for OHA, and they felt that they had to hire a PR firm in order to improve its image, all in the purpose of helping Native Hawaiian beneficiaries.
One would ask about improving an image as opposed to just focusing on some of the issues that people thought were important.
Yes. Well, as OHA actually has a strategic plan, it has six initiatives that it follows, and that includes education, aina, health, economic self-sufficiency. So there are a number of these things that they feel that they are already doing. In fact, the survey did show that most people recognized OHA really is advocating for Hawaiians. I can tell you that the CEO of OHA, Kamanao Crab, as well as Chair Robert Lindsay Jr., felt that the survey was very useful, that it really revealed insights into how OHA could do its job better. So what they're doing now is they're embarking on a strategic communications plan. They've hired Stryker Weiner for over the next 2 years to help OHA have a more unified voice in doing its mission.
And, of course, we'll see what that campaign looks like and how people react to it. Thanks a lot, Chad.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day with a reality check from Civil Beat. Sometimes you just get lucky. Late on Labor Day, an email popped up asking if anyone was at HPR who'd like to interview Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew. HPR News Director Bill Dorman replied, got a phone call, and then the security detail arrived, all because Jack Lew had decided to touch down in Honolulu for the day en route to Washington following the meeting of the G20, which was the first item Bill Dorman asked him about.
You know, I think that the G20 this year has actually been a very important place to come together at a time when there's a lot of anxiety in the global economy and a lot of uncertainty in the global economy, to make sure that there is sustained attention on the things that we all need to do and the things that we all need to not do. So there was I think, important agreement that was reaffirmed by leaders that the G20 countries should use all policy tools, fiscal policy, monetary policy, and structural reforms to great growth to a better rate.
Where's the growth come from?
You know, I think that the emerging economies are going to continue to have more growth potential than other economies. Is one of the reasons that we think trade agreement within the Pacific region is so important, because demand in the future is going to come from parts of the world where middle class incomes are growing. We want U.S. products and U.S. services to be able to compete. And we also want standards on things like labor rules and environmental protection and the things that help make our country what we are become more the norm. And we're already seeing countries that are in the TPP start to adhere to higher standards.
You are a political realist. You've worked on Hill. You've worked in several administrations in terms of making this go. When you come back now to Washington with Congress right now, number one, what any hopes at all in terms of TPP?
Yeah.
Number two, what do you expect out of this session of Congress?
We are, first of all, going to put every effort into getting it done. There is still time to get it done, and I believe there ultimately will be the support to get it done. I think that we have a real challenge because the facts in favor of TPP are very strong, but there's a lot of political sentiment that raises questions about going forward. We need to answer those questions. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of political debate in the next few weeks. When Congress comes back, it's going to become a fundamental question. Do we want the United States to be the leader in the area of the global economy that's going to be growing in the future? Or do we want to let another country, any other country, take that role? We should want the United States to be the leader. It's good for our economy. It's good for our national security.
The issue of economic inequality is something that certainly came to the front in the presidential campaign. Is more of an issue now, arguably, than it has been for a long time. How do you deal with that, not just in the context of TPP, but overall in terms of the remaining days and perhaps time ahead?
Look, I think that's an extremely important question here in the United States and around the world. There was a lot of discussion at the G20 about this issue, because I think there's a shared sense that we have public anxiety around the world that is raising questions about the proposition that a more efficient global economy offers benefits to the people working in those economies. Now, if you have that kind of skepticism, it's very difficult to win the support for trade agreements or international cooperation.
But
the
world's a better place. How is that different than a trickle-down argument?
So
if it's good for the corporations, it'll eventually get to the
consumers. It's not a trickle-down argument, because if you see global growth being stronger, if you see GDP in your own country being stronger, then the question is, how do you make sure the benefits go to working people? Well, first of all, a lot of countries, the United States included, could do a better job making sure people have the skills they need to participate in the global economy. We have 3 to 4 million jobs in this country that aren't filled, and 3 to 4 million people in this country who don't have jobs. Now, that's a mismatch, and you can solve that with better education and training. I just had a discussion with business leaders here in Honolulu, and what I heard from them was the lack of investment in infrastructure is a critical problem in terms of the economic future. Well, we've been saying that at the national level for years. We can solve that problem. We can invest in infrastructure, and while we're doing it, we're creating short-term good middle-class jobs and a strong economic foundation for the future. So these problems can be solved. The thing that is encouraging to me is there are things we know we can do that will help. And we have to overcome the political obstacles that have made it difficult to get those things done. Now, I think political dysfunction, you know, is something that we need to worry about. If the system seizes up, then even if you know the solution, you can't get it done.
You know, you have been involved politically in past discussions, negotiations that have been bipartisan in nature. What is missing now from the formula that at one time existed, or I hesitate to call it the politics of civility, but what is there that is not existent in current Washington that needs?
What we have to do is expand the space for honorable compromise. What has felt different in the last few years is the idea that compromise itself was bad. Compromise is how our system works. You don't get everything the way you want it, but you find the places that don't offend the principles of either party and keep moving the country forward. On a number of issues, we've been able to do that over the last several years. It would be good if we could do it on more issues. Infrastructure is a challenge that we ought to be able to do that on.
For residents of Hawaii, D.C. seems a little far away sometimes. What is it that you would leave with our listeners in terms of the Treasury Department and heading that up when it comes to Hawaii?
You know, Hawaii is one of our 50 states, so I think the things that we do for all of our states are important here. At the meeting I had with business leaders and community leaders in Hawaii, I was actually pleased to hear that the things we're doing at the Treasury Department to promote financial inclusion, to promote small business capital development, are actually helping here in Hawaii.
What did you hear from business leaders here that they're concerned about?
You know, I heard a lot about infrastructure. That was why I raised it. I heard concerns about how do you create the jobs of the future in Hawaii to keep educated, skilled workers in Hawaii. I think that is an issue in other places as well, but because of the distance of Hawaii from other markets, it has a special characteristic here. I was very pleased to be able to spend time listening to leaders in the community and the economy here, because every time you do that in another part of the country, it gives you another piece of the puzzle that helps you see how the whole fits together. We're never going to be a country where it will be one size fits all, and every community, every state needs exactly the same thing. But we ought to be able to have a toolkit that gives every state and every community the ability to create a better economic future.
Mr. Secretary, thanks for your time.
Great to be with you. Happy Labor Day.
Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew, who spoke with HBR News Director Bill Dorman during a surprise visit late Monday. You've probably heard the expression, dress for the job that you want. Rebecca Miller thinks the real phrase we should be telling ourselves is to act for the world we want. On Sunday, Rebecca Miller's team released the latest installment of the IUCN Red List, the species and eco environments in danger of being or which have already been lost. I asked her about this year's list and what now comes after it that might mitigate what sometimes feels like a hopeless situation.
Well, I think it's important to highlight that IUCN actually produces two lists. One is the Red List of Threatened Species, and the other is Red List of Ecosystems. And those look at different levels of biodiversity. So we may identify that there is rapid species loss. We may also see places where we haven't seen that species are lost yet, but we're seeing huge declines in ecosystem function. So we might see massive changes in forests or in coral reefs. Within that, some species may be better off than others. But regardless of what level of biodiversity you're looking at, the key is really to determine what can we do next. And in doing red list assessments, we identify some of the major symptoms of these declines, and those can then highlight what needs to change and what are the drivers of these declines and changes that we're seeing.
The red list is one of those lists where you don't really want to get on it, but once you're on it, it becomes the springboard to action, hopefully, or at least it creates a lot of attention around it. as you look at what we are dealing with here in Hawaii, for example, with rapid ohia death, or the fact that we've been dealing with situations with the corals, with Montipora and black band, and other things that are happening in our ecosystems, how do we look at that with a measure of certainty that we can do something about it when some of the players simply want to talk more about it than act?
Well, that's a really difficult question, and these are difficult questions in general that we're having to face. But in many ways, these are difficult times, but they can also be very inspiring times. I mean, you do what you can do. You know, some things like ohia death, if we don't understand where this is coming from, we don't understand the disease cycle or how to address those issues, then the first step is really to start looking into the basic research so that we can try and figure out what is the next step. It's like a human disease. If you're sick and you don't know why, then you need to figure out what the issue is before you can figure out what medicines you need to take or what treatment you need to take to address it.
Does that also mean, Rebecca, that we in some ways might have to make peace with losing more species and species that we don't even know about?
I think that's an unfortunate reality that's happening whether we want it to or not. I don't know whether we want to make peace with that because that means that we've accepted it. One of the key things is to realize that we can do something. It's a choice. And in many cases, we know what to do. We just need to stand up and decide as a society that we need to craft the world that we want to live in. I think we also need to realize that Hawaii is one of the biggest examples of species loss, of rapid ecosystem change. But this is also a symptom of what's happening worldwide. There are other places in the world that have extremely high levels of endangerment of species and ecosystems. As a human society, this is a sign that we need to step back and really change the way that we're inhabiting our planet, because ultimately it does affect us. We think that we're separate, but we're not, and we are being affected by these changes.
We've heard that message in some report for such a long time, and in Hawaii especially, because we are this tiny place in the middle of the Pacific, not close really to anybody else. And so it becomes, in a way, the perfect lab or the perfect storm, depending upon which way you want to look at it, for being able to watch a lot of species simply go away or to try to stand up and do what we can. There are a lot of people who are trying to stand up and do, as you say, what we can. In some cases, thwarted by development, thwarted by policies, thwarted by a lack of networking with other like-minded organizations. At what point does it become sort of that critical mass where citizens and organizations that don't want to see these species and ecosystems ruined any further have the clout to stand up?
I think we're already at that point. In many ways, people look at these sort of development processes and governmental processes and these industries as being the bad guy who's intentionally going about their business with a disregard to how it affects the environment. Many times they don't know what the impacts are. More and more we're finding that the private sector, that government is interested in how their actions are affecting the environment. And we have been able to forge really productive alliances with them to help them mitigate some of the actions that they're taking or to help them reduce the impact that they take. And I really want to highlight that every individual, every organization, no matter how small you feel, there's so much that can be shifted based on public demand. And if we say, no, we don't care, we just want to, you know, have our electronic gadgets and we want to continue with consumerist society, then that's the way that society will go. If we say, no, this isn't acceptable, we want to live in a world where we respect and we value nature, where we recognize the services that ecosystems provide, where we want clean air, we want clean water, we want to be able to live in a more equitable way with our environment. And enough of those voices come together, then decision makers will respond to that. Ultimately, that is their mandate, is to respond to public demand within reason and to make sure that society advances in a way that benefits.
Some note the irony that here we are in one of the most beautiful places on Earth, and yet it's tremendously threatened by many more people wanting to live and work here coming from elsewhere, and the great development that we're seeing. All you have to do is go out our doors and take a look into the skyline, and you'll see that there's so many more buildings going up, and not necessarily for people who live and work here, and we've had lots of conversation around that. That is an allied issue with what you just mentioned. What kind of a society do we really want? You said that there are those who are doing well, that you've been able to forge some alliances. Who would you point Hawaii toward to say, look, they've done this very well, and it might be worth emulating?
I think it really depends on the issue. I mean, this you know, we're looking at huge issues, and Hawaii is suffering from this population growth, but the world is suffering from population growth. I mean, in many ways, our footprint is bigger across the world than the world can handle, and that's extremely true here as well. So they seem like massive global challenges, especially when you look at them at a global scale. It's difficult to give any one specific example because it really depends on the kinds of impacts you're wanting to mitigate or, you know, what exactly you're looking at changing. There are hundreds of thousands of examples around the world of individual interactions that then, when built up, actually make a really significant change.
So to someone who feels powerless that he or she is living in a Hawaii that looks very different from the Hawaii of his or her youth and wants to ensure that it's going to be a better Hawaii for children and grandchildren. And we always say that, we always hear that, but to be able to take some real steps for that, what do you tell them?
Engage. Engage. Engage with your communities. Engage with your families. Take your children outside. Make sure that they understand the value of nature, that they understand their place. You know, there's a really severe disconnect in many places of the world between humans and nature. People need to get out. You know, we need to enjoy being outside. We need to, even if you don't enjoy it, understand our place in the natural world. So engage with your local communities. Get out there yourselves. Canvas. Write to your politicians. Write to your mayor. Write to your governor. You know, write to the president. Write to the president of companies that you learn are doing activities that you find unacceptable. Use your purchasing power. Purchase from companies that act in a way that align with your beliefs. And every step of the way, we can make a difference. It's how we choose to live our lives. It's, you know, deciding what kinds of consumer goods we buy, deciding the kind of food that we eat. It's simply trying to have a smaller impact on the planet ourselves. Educate those around you, especially the next generation, and make your voice heard to all of the governments and companies that you want to influence, whose actions you want to change. Speak to your neighbors. Really, just engage, and you know, every small step, when added up together, makes a massive difference.
I hear you say, pay attention and be very careful what you're paying attention to.
Yes.
Rebecca Miller, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rebecca Miller is a conservation ecologist with the IUCN who started her career studying endangered forest birds on the island of Hawaii. Her work now focuses on evaluating the status and trends of biodiversity. She's particularly interested in the intersection between biodiversity, conservation, and sustainable development, and thinks we should all be asking ourselves how to balance the needs of an expanding human population with the need to conserve the natural systems on which we all depend.
I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll learn about the state's efforts to reestablish native insect populations.
Saving the Kamehameha butterfly and the native yellow-faced bee will involve the government, researchers, and citizen scientists.
That's today at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
Aloha, I'm Nelson Bopp from Ohana Arts. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Stanley Kosasa, founder of ABC Stores, was the man who discovered that placing his retail outlets near each other improved sales in both locations. Other companies saw how well this worked and copied Kosasa's plan. But Stanley realized something else that helped the bottom line, and it's more important than distribution. Take good care of your employees. Recently, President and CEO of ABC Stores, Paul Kosasa, shared what his father taught him.
As a company, we're very generous for our employees. I learned from my parents. He said, you've got to take care of the employees because they're the ones on the firing front. They're servicing the customers. They understand where their salary is coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as the store is performing well or well enough, that they'll get paid. So they understood the concept of how customer service translates to financial stability.
The Kosasa family is well known for its philanthropy. Treating their employees well is one example of their philanthropic nature. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Whether it's taking good care of employees or taking good care of the ecosystem, taking good care is the key. And after hearing about the IUCN's Red Listed Species and Ecosystems, consider the subject of today's backyard quiz. We mentioned a bright red native Molokai bird that, could we even find one today, would definitely be on the red list. It was already endangered when naturalist Scott Wilson described it in the 1800s, in part because its scarlet red feathers made it highly prized for ali'ikihe, the royal feather cloaks. The bird's formal name, Paroea maiza, Flamea, means ball of fire, which it resembled flitting from tree to tree. Other causes of its extinction? Like those, it continued to threaten other endemic Hawaiian birds, habitat loss, avian-borne mosquito parasites, and introduced predators. This beautiful redbird's name, Kakavahie, in English, the Molokai honeycreeper. It's 8:52, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
As we've been doing all week, we are checking in with the hashtag Nature for All campaign, which was launched at the IUCN. It connects real people to nature and has approximately 90 partners to work in that project. June Chi is one of them. She's overseeing the K-12 working group for the 2016 IUCN. She just finished her work with Hawaii Students Day at the Congress, and we're curious about the takeaways of 900 kids and what happens next. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So yesterday, when we spoke earlier in the morning, not with you, but we heard that 900 kids were going to be arriving. Some were already there. How did the day go?
The day went really well. We did have 900 students from about 51 schools across the state, so we had schools fly in for the day. It was really super fun, and it went so well. The kids were really attentive and just loved every part of the activity.
Aside from being fun, what were the real takeaways that you wanted to make sure they walked away with?
I think for us, what was most important was, yes, learning about climate change and conservation and the issues that we're facing, but also to empower them, to give them a voice, and to show them that they have an opportunity to make a change now as a youth and not wait until they're an adult to actually make action.
That's sort of the broad umbrella of what happened, but were there any specifics that you really saw kids glomming onto that you saw them translate into action from an idea?
Yeah, well, I got to speak with a few of the students who were coming here. We actually did an exchange program with Canada and Hawaii students, and they were really passionate to go back to their communities and start groups there with their friends just to take them out and experience nature or go out and do a beach cleanup. Some of them had much more ambitious goals, like trying to get plastics out of their schools in the cafeteria. So definitely a lot of great examples like that. I'm actually going to go back today and look at all the storyboards and ideas that got put up on the wall more thoroughly. And those are actually going to be hung up for the rest of the week for all the IUCN members to see as well.
And what about networking all of those schools both here and in Canada?
I'm sorry?
And what about networking all that information with the schools both here and in Canada so that they can be in contact with each other and about the projects themselves that they're each working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So our partner with that program was the Canadian Wildlife Federation, and we're both really committed to continue programs like this, exchange programs in the future. And those kids, they were saying goodbye. All the Canadian students were flying out last night, and there were a lot of tears. I think they were really connected as friends now, so I have no doubt that they'll stay connected with each other.
So June, as that's leaving, very quickly, what's up for today?
The IUCN right now is in members' assembly, so we'll be voting the rest of the week on a motion that will be passed on conservation.
All right, June. Thanks so much for checking in with us.
Thank you.
June Chi is overseeing the K-12 working group for the IUCN. And previously, she mentored fellows on innovative energy solutions with Energy Accelerator and Kamehameha Schools. And that's going to bring us to the end of our hour, as now the members of the IUCN will be meeting today, and we'll see what some of the producibles are by the end of the week.
And with all the problems over environmental facing today, I'm really encouraged by the can-do attitude of scientists to solve problems in so many disciplines, like Dr. Vegsharayath. I mean, he is amazing, solving the problems of seeing through ripples. No matter what the discipline, it's if there's a problem, we can fix it. It's like this entire conference is showing so many younger minds working not to go, oh, we're in trouble, but to say, hey, we can fix it.
Or mitigate it. I mean, there are some things, as clearly we heard in our conversation with Rebecca Miller about the Red List. Well, we're not going to be able to fix all of those things, but there is something that we can do. That's the whole message of hope, and to hear her say it also of action, being very careful what we pay attention to and being willing to stand up and do something, however small it may be, especially when it comes to purchasing power. That's going to do it for us for this hour of the conversation. We'll be back with you tomorrow to talk about more about the importance of sacred ground. Filmmaker Toby McLeod will be here.
Plus, scientists discover a new deep reef butterfly fish species in Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument. If you want to be in touch, call the talkback line and leave us your name, town, and phone number, and we'll air your comments on Friday. Our number, 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Talk to us and each other on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or just want to hear something again, you can always find it on our archive. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Bill Sage.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.